Aloha, welcome to The Conversation. I'm Bill Dorman, in for Catherine Cruz. The Aloha Stadium Project has new life and a variety of community perspectives. We'll hear an important voice today from the neighborhood, the president of the IAEA Community Board. Is there a better way to get students to school? The school bus situation has improved this year around the state, but there are still challenges and some new ideas. We'll tell you about a pilot program. We take a peek inside the Forbidden Isle and hear about some of the details of its deal with the Navy. We meet two red-headed birds on this week's Manu Minute, and we learn how to tell them apart. We'll join in the celebration of 50 years of community gardens on Oahu and tell you where the growth is coming next. Aloha, you're tuned to The Conversation on HPR One. I'm Bill Dorman, in today for Catherine Cruz. Aloha Stadium remains in the news and on the minds of many of you. We heard from several of you during our live call-in show yesterday as we spoke about the latest projected completion date of 2029 for the new Aloha Stadium, with perspectives from the developers, the state, and a longtime local sportscaster. We also asked for your recollections of the Rust Palace, and we heard from one listener who left us this message on our talkback line.
I was able to take my dad, who's no longer with us, to the opening night ceremonies of the stadium, and they had a free dinner for all guests who appeared that night. And I also appeared with a friend of mine the first baseball game when the configuration was turned into a baseball configuration, and I caught the first ball hit by the player's bat, which went foul tip on the third baseline. And I also took my son to the first monster truck event at the Aloha Stadium. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Great collection of memories. Carol also called in to share her concerns about the development of a new stadium.
My name is Carol Abrigo. I live in Honolulu. When I worked at a hospital near the stadium 10 to 15 years ago, we were told by the hospital CEO that we couldn't increase the bed capacity due to the sewer not being able to support increased workload. I'm wondering now, how come we can build 4,500 more homes, living spaces, and a bigger stadium? Will the sewer be able to handle that? My second thing is, we don't have any professional sports to support a large stadium. I think the stadium should be for the students, so it should be on campus. Perhaps West Oahu campus would be a good building site. It has the rail also, and just focus on building houses in the Halaba area. I'm also very afraid of building something and the builder has no responsibility for quality. And perfect examples of that are our present situation with the convention center and the new state hospital, which the builder, you know, 2 years out has no liability now, and it's back on the taxpayers. It's appalling. And my biggest fear to the stadium build is that it seems to be, it could be a very sneaky way to push for legalized gambling. My greatest fear about legalizing sports gambling is that the suicide rate among young men who get into uncontrollable debt. So I'm totally not in favor of the stadium. Thank you for allowing my comments. Goodbye.
We appreciate your feedback. If you have a question or a comment, you can always leave us a voicemail at 808-792-8217. Sticking with Aloha Stadium, The Conversation's D.W. Gibson spoke with Steve Wood. He's the president of the IAEA Community Board, the community that's going to host the proposed 98-acre stadium and business district. Wood spoke about the questions and concerns he's heard from his community since the project was first discussed nearly 8 years ago.
I think people in general, at least in the IA community, they just don't want to see another situation like the rail, right? Where it just went on and on and on. And with every delay, there's a cost associated with that. So I think that they really want this project to start like as soon as possible. They expect it to start yesterday, honestly. I have asked repeatedly for timelines. I've been given a start timeline of, you know, a month, right? We've passed that month now. But, you know, more in-depth project timelines as we go forward will definitely be helpful in terms of addressing community concern. We've had developers come in. We're not shy about asking. And if they don't want to come in, I have no problems calling up one of the news stations and saying we're not getting anything from our developers about information that's important to the community. And that usually drags them in at that point. So,
yeah. A little public pressure never hurts. Are there any thoughts that you or any thoughts you've heard in terms of the sort of bigger ideas of how to develop? So there's the core of the stadium, but there's still a little bit like sort of out there undecided in terms of just how expensive the sort of business district gets. Are there thoughts or questions or perspective you have on those sort of outlying questions?
Right. So my understanding is that the money that's allocated now for the stadium is for just the stadium and maybe the infrastructure that is needed to build that stadium, right? So we're talking sewer, electrical lines, things like that. The developer, my understanding is that they're looking at like basically putting in additional buildings that will be co-located with the property or with the stadium. And that will be basically like a starter, right, to get more investment in there, to get more building put in there and that kind of activity. So that's what I'm anticipating now, and that's what this community is anticipating. Over the years, the plan, you know, the plan community is to have the elementary school down there, to have shops, to have 4,000 to 5,000 residential units for people to live in. It's got two hotels, will be there at the rail station, these kind of things. But for now, our understanding is it's just that stadium and those buildings to support.
Even if in unofficial ways, I think there are conversations that have been linked in terms of this stadium development and bigger questions around gambling in the state. Again, any sort of general thoughts from you or things you're sensing from the community on that front?
I kind of see it's a little bit of a slippery slope, I guess, with the you know, and the legislators are looking at that because what we don't want to do is end up as another Las Vegas, right? But then maybe there's a compromise there, right? Because one of the big things with this development is that it's going to need to generate some kind of revenue. As we see with like Las Vegas, there's no bigger revenue generator than gambling. So maybe there is a compromise there. Maybe we won't have slot machines and poker tables, right? But maybe we'll have something more catering to our culture here in Hawaii. That doesn't, you know, necessarily represent what's going on back on the mainland. Do I know the silver bullet? No, I don't. I wish I did. But I think there is some compromise there that we can have some form of gambling, maybe just not like what it is on the mainland. I know housing is another big concern. We just had Halava 2 building built down by across from Pearl Harbor. If you have a chance to go in there and take a look, it's pretty nice, actually. That kind of housing in that kind of area would be ideal to support our housing issues that we have here on Oahu. So I think that's another question. How are we going to get to those 4,000 to 5,000 residential units on that property in a time frame that's going to matter to people, right? 30 years from now, I don't know, you know, who knows if it's going to matter to people, but right now we need the units. And so how do we get there in a quick or in a timely manner? Outside of that, the other issues was like noise and traffic and these kind of things, but those have all died down. I haven't really heard anything from the community about those in recent years, literally since COVID. You know, the stadium, you know, in their defense, they really did work with this community and hold a lot of workshops and take into consideration a lot of the issues. And so those issues, once they were addressed, definitely died down, like the noise and traffic. I'm sure once the stadium starts getting, the current Aloha Stadium gets deconstructed here, that there'll be dust issues and there'll be noise issues and those kind of things that'll be brought up. And we'll just have to continue to work with the stadium authority and the residents and to try and find solutions to those issues. But I'm anticipating that. That's going to be one of the big things. Outside of that, everybody's pretty excited about it. I haven't heard anybody say, yeah, let's not build a stadium. That I haven't heard. So I think everybody's really excited about it. when and if it ever gets kicked off here, because it keeps getting delayed.
Yeah.
So.
Well, no, that's interesting, and that's good to know that it's just generally has been good, positive response. I mean, the only sort of upset or whatever has been a lot about timeline and not getting going, but people are generally receptive to the idea of, yeah, let's do this.
Yeah. And they're worried too. Like, a lot of the worry is that it'll end up as a rail project that'll just take an exorbitant amount of time and money above what was already allocated to get this done, right? And they don't want that. They want to get this done as quick as possible. Yeah.
I'm a little bit surprised to hear, but it sounds like people are just generally receptive to, look, let's get it going and let's move it forward. And those concerns of atmospherics, if you will, have died down a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, and they have. And I think a lot has to do with, honestly, is the previous project I mentioned, this, you know, over here across from Pearl Harbor. Around that time when the stadium was doing their workshops, they were presenting their plans to the board, neighborhood board, and there was a huge outcry about traffic. They managed it very well with that project. And so I think the residents have seen that and said, okay, well, maybe this isn't going to be as bad as I thought it was going to be, because it really didn't impact us when they spent the last 2 years building that particular structure. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. Everybody seems really receptive to the change as well, because, you know, they're going to reflow Salt Lake Boulevard. It's not going to tie into CAM anymore, and it's going to go around, kind of thing. And so everybody seems to understand that and seems to be okay with it. I haven't heard anybody raise a lot of issues in regards to the different traffic flows and things like that have been presented at this point. Like I said, I think everybody's really excited about it. I think one of the key things is that when they start actually building the community part and putting that elementary school in there, it'll alleviate the need for students to have to cross literally a freeway to get to their elementary school. So I think a lot of folks are looking forward to that as well too.
And that's where that stuff really redounds to timeline, because that's at the end of the pipeline. Yeah. So it's like, all right, are we talking?
Right. Yeah. It's like, you know, like the 2 years for the stadium to be, you know, they're talking 2028, right? So it would be actually 3 years from now to get into that football season. And then I think they've mentioned 20 years till the end of the development of the whole entire area. So that's a long time. It'll probably be past my time. Our board keeps tabs on it. Like, we're constantly, like every month we have the stadium authority brief us. We have a representative that sits on the stadium authority board that comes and tells us what is being discussed on those board meetings, not executive session stuff, but other stuff. I'm working with them pretty much once a week. I'm in contact with somebody over there to talk about something. And it might not necessarily be the current stadium stuff. It could, like, in terms of like this build, but it could be just like concerts, those kind of things, right? There's a good open line of communication between everybody involved.
That was IAA Community Board President Scott Wood speaking to HPR's D.W. Gibson about questions and concerns in his neighborhood about development of the new Aloha Stadium.
This weekend on The Real Deal, we'll spend time listening to America's greatest living jazz man, tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins. Join me, Seth Marco, 8 to 10 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday as we celebrate Sonny Rollins.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle-Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. If you're still thinking about Aloha Stadium, you're in luck, because today we want to quiz you on some stadium history. The old stadium was the first of its kind to offer four movable sections, which could be configured for football, soccer, and baseball games, not to mention concerts and novelty events like the 50th State Fair. Over the years, the Rust Palace hosted notable acts like Frank Sinatra, The Police, The Beach Boys, The Rolling Stones, Mariah Carey. But sporting events were the stadium's bread and butter. The soccer star Pele took the field in 1976. Olympian Duncan McDonald won the first Great Aloha Run in 1985. The National Football League held the Pro Bowl at the stadium through 2016. And over the years, a mix of college and professional talent played there. The first event held at Aloha Stadium was UH's season opener against Texas. But for today's quiz, can you tell us the last sporting event held at the old Aloha Stadium? And tell us who won. If you know the answer, call 808-941-3689. First one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
We're just about a month into the new school year, and Hawaii still has a shortage of school bus drivers. The Department of Education says it's not an emergency. The governor agrees after declaring an emergency for the last 2 years, but the problem has not been fixed, and there are some ideas being explored. HPR's Laura Dukes is here with a look at some of them.
Hi. Yeah, so the bus drive shortage, it's not as severe as it has been in the past few years. Last year, more than 138 bus routes were suspended. This year, the DOE says it's just 8 on Maui and on the Big Island.
That's some progress.
It is some progress. But, you know, the solutions that they've come up with, besides hiring more bus drivers, they've now expanded their express bus program, so taking the city bus to get to school. And then also they've started piloting a carpool app program. So that's currently happening in Mililani on Oahu and Ke Kaulike on Maui. So here's the DOE superintendent, Keith Hayashi, explaining other commuting options at the last board meeting.
In 14 schools across central Oahu and upcountry Maui, we're piloting the Go Kid carpool program to make family transportation coordination easier. The optional program helps families connect with nearby school families to share rides, easing the burden of daily transportation and reducing traffic. I know that there was some miscommunication that was on the news when the program first launched. GoKid is not a rideshare service. It helps parents arrange carpools among families within the school community, not with anonymous or assigned drivers. Parents can message other families, arrange to meet, and build trust before deciding whether to carpool or not.
In a way, this sounds like what if after-school activities, sports teams, things like that, after practice, parents coordinating carpools.
Yeah. I mean, basically, you can think of it as a large, organized group chat. And visually, I think to people being concerned, it visually does look like a rideshare app. So I think a lot of that confusion came up that way because you are seeing a map, you are seeing a list of people in your community. But yeah, it is like coordinating with people like after practice or, you know, just getting to school and finding an easier way to lift that burden onto parents. But, you know, for GoKid, this is the first partnership they've had with a DOE in the nation. And it possibly could be the largest deal they've ever made with 14 schools. They had to hire someone to work directly with the Hawaii market. And GoKid wouldn't give me a full list of schools they partner with, but the condensed list they gave me was mostly charter and private schools located in California. And the issue, I think, is because it's a third party, schools partnering with them don't know how many students are participating in it. GoKid kind of holds all of that data for them. What they did tell me is 160 people in Hawaii have signed up, according to GoKid. I spoke with Trish LaChica, who's the state representative for Mililani and Waipahu. Mililani, to me, was interesting for a few reasons. LaChica told me that parents before the app were already building their own carpool community. So mm-hmm. in a way, it was a perfect place to pilot the app since that foundation was already there. And it's also home to the biggest middle school in the state. Mililani Mauka is like over 1,600 students. But Mililani Mauka is also kind of a tricky middle school to get to because there's only one road to get there and it's not central to Mililani. So, and because there's one road, imagine thousands of families like driving their own vehicles up this hill to get in it. So it can be pretty congested. So what LaChica told me is that while there are buses that are suspended, it doesn't include the buses that have been canceled. So in Mililani Mauka, there is a bus that has been canceled and there's no plan for it to return. So that's not included in the number of suspended routes.
It's the Mililani Mauka route that's right by the park and ride, but on the Mauka side by McDonald's area. So there's a lot of families. They're like closest to the middle school, but also there just hasn't been a driver, from what I've heard, that could fulfill that route. So the kids that live in that area would either need to receive a holo card, which is now available to all middle school students, and take public transportation, the bus, or find a way to be able to get to school either through walking or biking.
It is by a park and ride, so, you know, there is a large bus stop there. But the bus to get into Mililani Mauka is relatively small, and it runs every 45 to an hour, so it's not entirely convenient for students. According to Mililani Middle School, 34 families have signed up for GoKid, which is around 2% of the entire school's population, and 33% or so take the bus, one-third.
Right. So that's getting those numbers down to something that's usable and something that makes sense to do.
Yeah. Where it's, you know, I think it's the pilot program's still really small. It's relatively new. Mm-hmm. Mililani Middle School is planning to have a meeting sometime in the fall to just see how the community feels about the app. So that's still scheduled for later. Mm-hmm. But another issue that LaChica and I talked about was just kind of the requirements to qualify to take a school bus. If you're like K through five, it's a 1 mile radius. And then after that, you can take a school bus. But for sixth grade and above, you have to be a 1.5. And the issue that she talked about is that people that live just right on the edge of that border and they can't qualify.
The feedback that we still continue to get are just from the routes that have never been restored, as well as the qualification requirements. Like, we live just right outside, you know, in the 1.5 mile zone, or it takes an hour and a half to get my kid home. Like, you know, what are just different kind of challenges that related to the current situation?
Going back to when all of this was starting with the issues of bus shortages. LaChica actually spearheaded a bill to use alternative vehicles. So for the past 2 years, Governor Green signed an emergency proclamation to allow alternative vehicles like charter buses to fill the gap. So the idea was to use Roberts or ground transportation or any other vehicles sitting around, which could really help out rural areas. So this was used the past few years, so all the kids got to ride in a really nice bus with the TVs. This proclamation's now law. Governor Green signed it back in May. And LaChica hoped that it would open the door to new transportation alternatives to just help fill these routes. But nothing's really been done about this bill going anywhere, and the DOE's not really enforcing it. The DOE didn't comment on the bill to me, and LaChica doesn't know where it stands right now.
When I reached out to them, and when vendors reach out to them, they told us that they would have to wait for the next procurement cycle. And that could be years away, years and years away. But when we consulted with the Attorney General, the current contract does give them the authority to amend the contracts now. It's just very challenging and it is complex because it requires a willingness both on the department as well as from the current contractors to act.
Yeah, so the issue is, you know, these bus drivers for schools have contracts and we don't really want to break those contracts, but also we need to fill this gap somehow. And for La Chica, she thinks that, you know, we've built what it takes to fix this crisis with the bill, but we're not utilizing it.
So it sounds like a complex situation that's still very much in motion. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
HPR's Laura Dukes on some creative approaches to getting kids to school. When we think of large landowners in Hawaii, names like Larry Ellison and Mark Zuckerberg may come to mind. But the Robinson family owns a total of 100,000 acres of land, more than both Ellison and Zuckerberg. This includes the entire island of Niihau, where a handful of residents live and work under secretive conditions. Guthrie Scrimger is a freelance investigative reporter who covers wealth and power. He recently wrote about Niihau and interviewed Keith Robinson for an article in Business Insider. Scrimger spoke with the conversation's Maddie Bender about his story.
We had you on before talking about Mark Zuckerberg's holdings on Kauai. You are back with a story about the island of Niihau. How'd you get interested in learning more?
Yeah, so I lived on Kauai for a couple of years, and it is always kind of a big mystery for people living on Kauai. You know, what's going on with this island off our western shore? It seems like a lot of people are reticent to talk about it, and there's a lot of myths around it. So I really wanted to dive in and try to understand the island and the family that owns it.
So in this piece, which you wrote for Business Insider, one of the lines you wrote was, the first rule of Niihau is that you don't talk about Niihau, especially not to journalists. So how'd you go about sourcing?
Yeah, so it is really hard to get people to talk about Niihau. One thing that I learned over the course of reporting this is that that's actually a kind of formalized arrangement. I came across this op-ed that Keith Robinson, one of the owners of Niihau, wrote in 1998, where he describes living on the island as a kind of deal where, like, Niihauans can live there rent-free, but in return, they're required to live what he describes as a reasonably moral lifestyle. And they also can't do or say anything that could negatively affect the Robinsons. So yeah, getting people to break what is basically an informal NDA was very hard. I did manage to speak to a few former Niihauans, and a lot of the piece did come from finding Keith Robinson, who I was able to go up into the woods with him and do a long-form interview and spend a day with him.
What was that like to talk to this man who I imagine you had a lot of questions for?
Yeah, well, Keith Robinson is a really fascinating character. He's this mix of, you know, definitely a far-right ideologue and also like an ardent conservationist who has done a ton for conservation, both of culture on Niihau, but also as a botanist. And so I went up into his endangered species preserve. I looked at some of the plants that he had been growing there. He like describes his philosophy on the world and on Niihau and conservation. Basically, he does have this impression of the world as like a very morally decayed place. He has written a book where, you know, he interprets biblical prophecies to predict like a coming apocalypse coming pretty soon. And yeah, like I said, he sees the world as decayed and full of drugs and crime. And he very much wants to keep that culture out of Niihau. I think that's a driving motivation for him.
Yeah. And I mean, this might be history that listeners are already aware of, but the Robinsons have been the owners of Niihau since the mid-1800s when they purchased the land from the Hawaiian monarchy. How many people are living on Niihau? What would you say people are there for, and what are they doing?
It's hard to say exactly how many people live on Ni'ihau. You know, it's very shrouded in mystery. It seems to have been getting smaller. So I looked at the voting totals for the island over the past decade or so. Showed there were, I believe, about 100 registered voters in 2012. And now there were only 47 in 2024. So it does seem like it's getting smaller. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it is like a relic of a previous time where there's no Wi-Fi, electricity, except for solar panels. There's no running water. You know, natives there, a lot of them now work for the military base, which operates two stations. They do assistance with PMRF activities across the channel. And many of them also do Ni'ihau shell lay crafting. But there's a lot of back and forth, too. So folks that live on Ni'ihau, they often travel back and live for a few months on Kauai and go back and forth between the two islands.
And talk a little more about the contracts and agreements between the Navy and the Robinson family, like Ni'ihau Ranch, that you were able to uncover through public records requests.
Yeah, so it seems like the military is a primary source of funding for the Robinson family. So between 2000 and today, I found records of at least $25 million in military contracts between the Navy and Ni'ihau Ranch. Those contracts are really interesting because there are some pretty heavy restrictions on what military personnel can do there. One thing in the contract is that military officers on island, they aren't allowed to carry firearms, drink, do drugs, or do or say anything that could be construed as adversely affecting the Robinsons. And there was also a clause in the contract that said the Robinsons can forbid people from entering the island if they perceive that they may violate some of these terms. So I found that very interesting that even the military are bound by a lot of restrictions that the Robinsons can place on them.
And I guess, you know, like what else did you find out here? Like any mysteries that you feel like you've been able to resolve? Or for you, is it a lot of unanswered questions you still have?
Yeah, I think there's definitely more questions than answers. I did think, it was interesting just to learn the character and personality of Keith Robinson, who is a main figure in running Ni'ihau. One other thing that I found interesting was that historically, the state government used to be kind of adversarial towards the Robinsons and Ni'ihau. And there was an instance that I hadn't known about in 1970 when Governor Burns actually tried to purchase Ni'ihau for $300,000, which seems like an incredible lowball offer. But that move was actually ultimately shut down in part by Ni'ihauans themselves who spoke out against the move. And these days, it seems like the government is much more amenable towards the Robinson family and just letting them do what they want with Ni'ihau. I think a big part of the reason for that is because there's kind of a fear that if the Robinsons were to sell Ni'ihau, it might get sold to like a billionaire developer who wouldn't have as much interest in preserving the Ni'ihauan way of life. And yeah, one example of that was in 2022 when the Kauai County Council passed a tax break that gave Robinsons about a 90% decrease in their property tax on Ni'ihau from the year prior. And one of the reasons that council members gave for that was because they wanted to prevent the possibility of the Robinsons ever selling that land to a billionaire.
So it seems like for now, it's kind of a leave it alone, let them do whatever they're doing, and don't ask too many questions.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for taking the time, Guthrie.
All right, thank you.
That was investigative reporter Guthrie Scrimger talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. He wrote about Keith Robinson and the island of Ni'ihau for Business Insider. We'll have a link to his article on our website after today's show.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, committed to the conservation and protection of water resources for Oahu. Learn more about how to reduce water waste at boardofwatersupply.com.
the World takes you outside U.S. borders and connects you with the most important events happening all across this big blue marble. We introduce you to memorable people whose stories will stick with you. I'm Carolyn Beeler, global news and inspiring voices that connect us with people around the globe. Join us weekdays on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Thanks for coming along with us this morning. We've got not one, but two birds for you today. Thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, we can listen to the songs of both the red-crested cardinal and the yellow-billed cardinal. Can you tell the difference? University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart has some help with your Manu Minute.
Red-crested cardinals and yellow-billed cardinals are closely related birds that aren't even cardinals at all, but a type of tanager. Both are native to South America and were introduced to Hawaii, with the red-crested arriving on Oahu around 1930 and the yellow-billed first arriving in Kona on the Big Island in the early 1970s. Red-crested cardinals, also known as Brazilian cardinals, are common on all the main Hawaiian islands except the Big Island, whereas the yellow-billed cardinals are only found on the Big Island. Males and females of both species have beautiful red heads, blackish backs, and bright white breasts. Where they really differ is described by their common names. The yellow-billed have bright yellow bills, whereas the red-crested cardinal has just that, a red crest. Juveniles of both species have brownish instead of red heads. The songs have been described as similar, but see if you can tell the difference. Here's the red-crested song. And here's the yellow-billed song. Both the red-crested and the yellow-billed prefer lower elevation areas and can be commonly seen in backyards, parks, gardens, and orchards, where they feed on a variety of foods such as seeds, fruits, and insects. Unlike most of our native birds, these birds are able to live in the lowlands of Hawaii because they're resistant to the effects of avian malaria. Neither the red-crested nor the yellow-billed pose much of a current threat to any of our native birds, as there isn't much overlap in their diets or habitats. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, connecting the community with the Manu Oku through programs to promote awareness, appreciation, and conservation of the official bird of Honolulu. Learn more at hiaudubon.org.
It's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we walked you through some of the sporting history of Aloha Stadium. Stadium played host to soccer, baseball, and football games over the decades, as well as rugby, motorcycling, and tractor pulling. Robbie Knievel, the son of Evel Knievel, attempted a 150-foot jump off a ramp in Aloha Stadium in 1989. He crashed on his first attempt, but the very next day got back on the bike and completed the jump. We asked you to tell us the last sporting event held at the old Aloha Stadium. It was 4 years ago, the 2021 Hula Bowl. Carlo Kemp of the University of Michigan scored the last points in the stadium, a pick-six touchdown. And the winning team? Team Kai, coached by Rex Ryan. We had no winners today, but if you have a backyard quiz, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Gardens have been an important part of urban landscapes and indigenous communities for thousands of years. Community gardens are a particular niche where community members get a place to grow their own plants. Here in Honolulu, 2025 marks 50 years of community gardens, and the mayor has proclaimed September as Community Gardening Month. This spring, we planted some seeds of an idea, asking urban gardeners to share their community garden joy with us. After a summer of weeding and watering, it's time for the conversation's Lillian Song to harvest the bumper audio crop. In the first of our series, we take you to Oahu's windward side, where we meet Leanne Briggs, co-chair for the Honolulu Community Garden's 50th anniversary.
Aloha, my name is Leanne Briggs, and I have been gardening here at Kaneohe Community Garden for 15 plus years. I didn't know there was a community garden in Kaneohe until a friend of a friend told me, and that's how I joined. My first leadership position was chair of the pot committee. We had a plethora of potted plants in individual garden plots and around the garden. Our little committee came up with some rules. We shared with members and discussed, refined, and the rules were added to our bylaws. Since then, I have been president, assistant treasurer, and now I'm treasurer of Kaneohe Community Garden. I just love gardening. I love driving to the garden and getting out of my car, looking up at the beautiful ko'olau, and in the garden, plenty of sunshine, fresh air, exercise, and of course, growing vegetables to take home. The gardeners are tremendous fun, very positive, sharing gardening tips, recipes. It's a great community. I call my garden plot the grand experiment. Even after 15 years of gardening, I still run into problems, and you have to give it a try and see what happens. It's a constant state of learning and experimenting, and sometimes you get some good results. If you don't get good results, then you have to try again. I also feel like I'm making a contribution to my community by practicing good gardening methods, appreciating the soil of Kaneohe, the environment of Kaneohe, and contributing to the social fabric of my neighborhood.
Kaneohe Community Garden past president and treasurer Leanne Briggs talking with HPR producer Lillian Song. Leanne has a container garden at home, prepping plants with her plethora of pots to get ready for transfer to the Kaneohe Community Garden plot. The wait list to get into that garden? Last check, more than 15. Wait lists are a part of the community garden experience in Honolulu, but more gardens are coming. In fact, the theme of this year's golden anniversary year of the program is Keep Growing. A week from Saturday, there'll be a celebration to mark that 50th anniversary. We found out more about that when Kate Eichsted dropped by our studios yesterday afternoon. She's the community gardens coordinator working with the Department of Parks and Recreation. Aloha, Kate. Thanks for coming in to talk about this today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
You know, 50 years of community gardens, this is a very popular program here.
Yes, it is. It's very popular. People are contacting me daily through our online inquiry form and through our phone line and email line, just wanting to know more and to get on that wait list to get a little plot of their own.
And that wait list is in the hundreds.
Yes. It varies across different gardens, but I did do a little peek at the wait list before we talked today, and it is around 550.
Ah, down from what it used to be.
Yes, during COVID, I think it got into around 1,000.
Wow. And there are 11 community gardens in the city and county of Honolulu.
Correct.
And spread around. Demand for even more, particularly on the west side. Prospects?
Oh, of course, yes. Gardens are definitely wanted in almost every community across the island. We do see that we do ask for zip codes when people are inquiring so we could get a little bit more knowledge on where we might go in the future. But the plan is to continue to grow this program that has been so successful for the last 50 years. I hope that people will be excited to know that we are planning for growth. And on our website, there is a section called Planning for Growth, and it does outline our steps and what we're looking for, and just a little bit more about that endeavor. But another garden is in the works.
And it's interesting when you are choosing a plot for a community garden. There's a lot involved in that. It's not simply, well, here's some land that's in a general area and that should work. It's a very involved process. Talk about that a bit.
Sure. Yeah, when we're looking at a new site, we really are looking for what's going to work for the community. We're looking for land that's on DPR property. We're also looking for things that we've learned in these past 50 years. So sites that are located near bus stops, sites that are located near a lot of residential, public housing, that people can easily access the garden. We're also looking at parks that have restrooms located nearby already, that already have a water source located in the park. So these things really help us identify the physical location. However, we also did a geospatial analysis to help us map the island for other factors as well, such as Native Hawaiian population, low-income areas, and other vulnerable populations.
So really, equity is a factor in this
yes,
as well.
Yes, we definitely want to grow with equity in mind.
And keep growing is the theme of, I guess, the anniversary year, on the 50th anniversary. You also are in a situation where you've had new rules coming in May. Well, you revised a number of things. What, I suppose, was most difficult to wrestle with, or is it just the transition of moving, updating 50 years of rule changes?
Sure. Well, updating the rules within the Department of Parks and Recreation, it's really policy change. So there's a lot that goes into that. Even before I started with the department 2 years ago, this ball was rolling with the people before me, trying to get input from gardeners, you know, collecting the data, you know, getting drafts together of possible new rules. And then when I started, we just had to take it across the finish line. And that was a lot of community engagement within our program, and then having a public hearing, and just making sure that paperwork gets done and signed appropriately. And we finally got it passed. And I think that it's a really great set of rules that will help us grow into the future, that gives us a great guideline on how we can continue and be sustainable.
You know, one aspect that certainly was not front of mind 50 years ago and in years since, but invasive species in gardening, in compost and cuttings, that's a whole new set of concerns, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, definitely. In our previous rules, it didn't mention anything about that. But also, we didn't know anything about the coconut rhinoceros beetle
sure.
in 1975. And so as we grow and continue on, we need to make sure that we are good stewards of the aina. So we do have some protocols in place for our coconut rhinoceros beetle, also the little red fire ant, because we want to make sure we are protecting these parklands that are public.
The anniversary celebration coming up. This is a week from Saturday at Foster Botanical Gardens, downtown Honolulu. Talk about that a bit.
Yes. We are celebrating our 50th year, and we are going to have a celebration. It's going to be at Foster Botanical Garden. The community garden program is actually housed within our botanical garden program. So it just is a fitting place to have the event. It's going to be a great celebration where all 11 gardens get to come together, which is a rare thing to get together with other gardens. But not only that, but we welcome the public as well. And we have quite an array of exhibitors from our community forestry team to other INA-based community organizations that will be there as well to help us celebrate and educate the public and our gardeners. So it'll be a really great day. Not only will it be garden focused, but we will have music, we will have some presentations, and we'll have some food trucks. So it'll just be a great day to get together and celebrate gardening together.
You know, you mentioned along the way the role that volunteers play in the program. As so much of Hawaii runs on volunteer efforts and help and labor, but certainly that's the case in the gardening program.
Oh, yes. Our community gardens only could operate through volunteerism. Each garden has a set of officers that are leaders in their garden that operate the day-to-day, the special projects, meetings, the community garden cleanups, and the same thing is happening for this 50th anniversary. We have two committee chairs who have been working diligently for the past 2 years that have had a team on their committee just planning for this event. So it is a labor of love, this event, bringing, you know, a passion of theirs and getting to share that with the community. So I get to work with just some wonderful people that I share a passion with as well.
The passion for community gardens goes deep, deep roots on that. One of the questions, I guess, under some of the rule changes are about trees. Trees are in some places, I suppose, not in a lot, but the fate of trees that have been planted have grown to certain heights. There are limits now, yes?
Correct. We do have some limits on trees in our plots, and we do ask gardeners to remove any trees that are in ground. And we do allow trees in our gardening program, but we ask that they are put into pots. This rule comes because of trees, you know, they can grow quite large, shading out your neighbor's plot. Often those roots will leach your neighbor's nutrition from their plots and also wreak a bit of havoc on our plumbing system that is aging as well.
The roots, yes. There is so much to celebrate, really, on this 50th anniversary of community gardening and the idea of continued growth. Thanks for coming in and talking a bit about that. Honolulu's Community Garden celebrating 50 years. And again, you can join the main event celebrating that 50th anniversary a week from Saturday, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., September 13th at Foster Botanical Gardens, lovely and peaceful part of downtown. And it's all free.
Correct.
Kate Eichstead runs the Community Gardens program and is Community Gardens Coordinator. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
It's time to go today. Tomorrow, we'll get an update on alleged vote discrepancy on Kauai. The state elections office is out with a report refuting the allegations. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Catherine Cruz will be back tomorrow when you can join us for more of The Conversation.